Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Psalms chapter 11. I'm going to do all seven verses in this psalm, and we will call the psalm, "The Lord is in His Holy Temple." The title of the psalm is for the director of music of David, so this is a Davidic psalm. Psalms number 2 through 11 so far have been written by David. We start in verse 1. David says, "I have taken refuge in the Lord. How can you say to me, 'Escape to the mountain like a bird'? For look, the wicked string the bow. They put the arrow on the bowstring to shoot from the shadows at the upright in heart." And of course, the upright in heart is referring to David himself personally. And once again, David mentions his enemies. I've noted as we've gone through the first several psalms in the book of Psalms that David is always complaining about his enemies. He must have had 1,000 enemies. Now, David refers to someone here. He says, "How can you say to me, flee, escape?" I think that's just a general "you," not referring to anybody in particular. The NIV Study Bible and Gill say, "We don't know who told David to flee." I don't think David is referring to anybody in particular saying to flee. It's just a rhetorical device, in my humble opinion. We do know that on several times David did flee. For example, he fled from Saul. Seems like the whole book of 1 and 2 Samuel is about David fleeing from Saul. And we know, of course, that David fled from Absalom in 2 Samuel during Absalom's rebellion. He fled Jerusalem. So David was fleeing. But here, and we don't know when this happened in David's life, but whenever it was, David is saying, "I can't flee because the bad guy's going to shoot me with an arrow as I go." And of course, all this might be rhetorical. He might be talking about escaping a situation, not physically, but maybe just a complication in his life. But at any rate, it looks bad. He's got enemies. And his enemies are going to string their bow and shoot the arrows right at David. So we go to Psalm 11, verse 3. "If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do?" Now, this psalm is quoted a lot. And of course, the quotation is given in context of the destruction of the morals of a nation. Oh boy, America's foundations have long been destroyed. We're living in a upside-down moral universe now where evil is good and good is evil. Well, if the foundations are destroyed, and as we apply that verse to America, the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? So David is worried in his case, what can he do if the foundations of his society are destroyed? Now, was he referring to the moral foundations of his society? The moral foundations of his society, which was based on God's law? The NIV Study Bible and Jameson Foster Brown suggest this. One of my commentators suggested it might have actually referred to the events during Saul's reign when Saul murdered all the priests at Nob, if you recall that story. And David is saying, well, the foundations of Saul's kingdom are destroyed. The priests are being murdered. I don't know. That's just a speculation. In general, this is a very good verse to apply anywhere. You don't have a moral foundation for what you're doing. What can the righteous do? How about Sodom and Gomorrah? What could Lot do? Righteous Lot, he's called. What could he do? He's got homosexuality all around him, as well as pagan idolatry all over the place. He had to flee as God judged Sodom and Gomorrah. He had to flee. That's what he had to do. But I think the implication in this psalm is that the righteous are supposed to rebuild the foundations. It's a rhetorical question. David doesn't answer it. What can the righteous do? Well, he's saying, look, you get so bad that you don't have the moral foundation of your society, the righteous people in that society are going to be persecuted and hurt and oppressed. We go down to Psalms 11, 4 through 7, and we will get another idea of what the righteous can do. The righteous can depend on God to judge the wicked who have destroyed the foundations of David's society. We look now at Psalm 11, verses 4 through 7. "The Lord is in His holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. His eyes behold, His eyelids test the sons of men." Well, where is God? He's in His own holy temple. He's in heaven. Those two phrases are in parallel, and so I tend to take that as meaning that here, God's holy temple is heaven. That's where God is. Now, there's some other options that have been suggested. First, it can't be the temple in Jerusalem that has not been built yet until Solomon's time. Solomon lived after David, of course. But it could be the tabernacle, which was sometimes called a temple, because a temple is a place where God lives, and God lived in the tabernacle. So that's a little bit confusing when you see, I remember, I forgot where it was, going through the Old Testament, you see temple, and I say, wait a minute, temple's not built yet, it's referring to the tabernacle. So that does happen. And which tabernacle? Remember, there were two tabernacles. There was the one during David's time at Gibeon. And then David moved to the tabernacle from Gibeon into Jerusalem when he wanted to bring the ark from Kiriath-Jearim into his new tabernacle in Jerusalem. So whether it's Moses' tabernacle at Gibeon or David's tabernacle in Jerusalem, it could be either one of those. Some people suggested that it's a copyist error that temple erroneously replaced tabernacles. So it should read, actually, the Lord is in his holy tabernacle. Well, who knows? Who cares? Some people have speculated that God is in his holy temple. He is in creation, because creation is considered God's temple because he lives in the midst of his creation. I think that's a stretch. So I'm going to go with heaven because of the parallelism here. The Lord is in heaven. He's in his holy temple. And from there, he looks down and he tests the sons of men. In other words, he's seeing all of these evil people who are destroying the foundations of David's society. Those people who are pulling their bowstring back to shoot an arrow at him. God's looking. Verse 5, the Lord tests the righteous and the wicked. Verse 4, he tests the sons of men. Verse 5, he tests the righteous and the wicked. Now that word test is slippery. It's ambiguous in English. It's very close to the word to tempt, and also the English to try. It's also very problematic in Chinese too, as I discovered when I was in China. I still remember the word shertan. Jesus went out to the desert to be shertan by the devil. Well, does that mean that the devil was tempting Jesus? Or does it mean he was just giving him a hard time and testing him to see whether he was going to pass the test or not? There's a difference in meaning. One tests someone to prove that they're worthy or unworthy. So sometimes test is translated to prove. Like you test gold, you put fire on the gold. If the gold passes the test, it's gold. But if it melts into slag, well, then it failed the test. If your algebra teacher gives you a test to prove that you know the algebra, you either pass the test and prove that you know the algebra, or you fail the test and show that you are unworthy. However, if one tempts someone, you're not trying to help them. You're not trying to prove whether they're worthy or unworthy. You are trying to destroy them. So we need to keep that distinction in mind here. Verse 5, the Lord tests the righteous and the wicked. He's trying to prove them. He's not trying to tempt them. He's trying to prove whether they are righteous or whether they're wicked. And once he does that, at the end of verse 5, the one who loves violence, his soul hates. Oh, God hates someone? Well, yes, that's what this verse says. Contrast what David says with what God says in The Shack by William P. Young, one of the biggest pieces of literary garbage that has ever been written, even though it sold scadzillions of copies for all the young new evangelical Christians who were walking around in their bare feet and their ankle-tight blue jeans with their hair skin tight to their temples as it puffs up in the middle. This is what The Shack says about God. God is asked this question: are there any who you are not especially fond of? Here's the answer. She. Now, who's speaking here? It's a she. God is called a she in The Shack, an egregious example of gender confusion. God is called a she, and she's also called Papa, so we can kind of mix the genders. Well, okay. I realize that God has no gender. He has all the feminine and all the masculine characteristics tied up in himself. So I won't complain about that too much right here. She, Papa, lifted her head and rolled her eyes as if she were mentally going through the catalog of every being ever created. Nope, I haven't been able to find any. You have not been able to find anyone that you are not especially fond of? You are especially fond of Adolf Hitler, Pol Pot, Xi Jinping. Give me a break. And of course, The Shack is just illustrative of the modern wussy-pussy evangelical attitude that there is no sin in the world that we can't just poo-poo, and God's not going to judge it because we have ultimate reconciliation. You are, I think they call it now. I remember so well that there was a gentleman that we asked to speak at a house church conference. We ran that conference for 14 years, the Southern House Church Conference. And we had this guy, and he had a blog, and he's a very qualified sort of guy, and he was one of our speakers one time. And one of my associates was reading his blog, and he had turned the blog over to this woman who was blogging on the blog. She was a sub-blogger. And she just basically said, we need to believe in ultimate reconciliation. Nobody's ever going to hell. Well, my friend let the blog owner hold it about that. I says, well, you know, it's one thing to tolerate differences of opinion. It's another thing to be a doggone heretic. And this is heresy. And to his credit, the gentleman shut the sub-blogger down, the ultimate reconciliationist, down, so she wasn't able to blog anymore. But just to think that he allowed that to even start with shows how ridiculous the American church is, except for reformed people. They understand the justice of God. They understand hell. They understand that if there's no hell and there's no justice and there's no judgment, then there's no love either, because the wicked will take over. And speaking of the Southern House Church Conference, one of the attendees at our conference that we held for 14 years was the gentleman who published The Shack, ironically enough. And I learned from my experience in the Southern House Church Conferences, we had people from all sorts of theological stamps all over the country and sometimes from overseas too. And I got to see how people were thinking out there in the modern evangelical church. And the house church movement, of course, attracted people who were out of the mainstream. And I saw firsthand the nonsense, the theological accommodation that was being carried on in so many quarters. And doggone if the guy who published The Shack was not at one of our conferences. Because as soon as I saw his name on the book, I said, whoa, look at this. Well, end of rabbit trail. Well, David wasn't a wussy-pussy evangelical. He says in verse 5, the one who loves violence, his soul hates. And let me tell you something. Adolf Hitler loved violence. So did Paul Pot. So did Joseph Stalin. So did Mao Zedong. They loved violence. And David says, God's soul hates the one who does violence. I've got no problem with that. Verse 6, David continues, upon the wicked he will rain snares, the New American Standard Bible has. That's not really a good translation. I don't think most translations have. He will rain burning coals on their head. The NIV and the Holman Christian Study Bible have burning coals. So upon the wicked, God will rain burning coals. Fire and brimstone and burning wind will be the portion of their cup. Fire and brimstone is probably a reference to Sodom and Gomorrah, as Gill and Clark suggest, Genesis 19:24. Then the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. I think that's referring to the sulfur. Brimstone is sulfur. The sulfur that's found at the brim of a volcano. That's why they call it brimstone. That sulfur and fire, that's what a volcano does. It belches out sulfur and fire, and that's probably what happened to Sodom and Gomorrah. Some people, the NIV Study Bible suggests, that this fire and brimstone which will be rained upon the wicked will come at the end of the world in the final judgment. Could be both. The NIV Study Bible suggests that fire and brimstone refers to a desert dweller's worst nightmare of punishment, whatever that means. Probably a volcano blasting them, I don't know. The burning wind would apply to somebody that lives in the desert. Fire and brimstone and burning wind will be the portion of their cup. Because that sirocco, that hot eastern desert wind, I remember reading somewhere that it will turn you black, your skin black, and then your insides will start boiling, and you die a hideous death. Forgot where I read that, but it's nothing to mess around with, that burning desert wind. I remember I was in a wind that was 140 degrees Fahrenheit once at this place in China, which is on top of a mountain out in western China. And I remember getting dizzy and thinking, I'm going to die here if I don't get out of this wind. I mean, boy, it was brutal. I went into one of the caves there where this ancient civilization lived. So this is a great metaphor. Bad stuff's going to happen to the wicked. Oh, no. Papa, the female god in the shack, says, no, everything's going to be all right. You know, people that go around telling people that are doing them the greatest disservice, the greatest act of hatred that you could do, to tell somebody, you don't need to worry about anything. God's going to take care of you. You don't need to repent. Repent? Oh, that's old-fashioned. That's just for fundamentalists. That's not for modern Christians. We only believe in love. Fire and brimstone and burning wind will be the portion of their cup. The cup is a typical metaphor used in the Old Testament. It can either refer to God's favor or to his wrath. Here's some scriptures. Psalm 16:5. The Lord is the portion of my inheritance and my cup. So it's what you get from God, what you inherit from God. You, God, support my lot. In other words, my land is my portion. It's my inheritance. It's good stuff that comes from God. So cup is there used in a positive sense. Psalms 23:5. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You have anointed my head with oil. My cup overflows. Well, there it's a cup that has wine in it, and it overflows. The wine would be a symbol of joy and prosperity. So their cup is a positive image. Here is a verse where a cup is used in a negative sense, Matthew 20, verses 22 through 23. Jesus answered, he answered his disciples, "You do not know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I'm about to drink?" Jesus is referring to his crucifixion, and therefore the cup is that which comes from God, which is bad. He's going to get nailed on the cross. They, the disciples, said to him, "We're able to drink the cup, Jesus." Jesus said to them, "My cup you shall drink." In other words, you're going to get crucified like I'm going to get crucified. Most of them were. "But to sit on my right and on my left, this is not mine to give, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared by my Father. My cup you shall drink." So there we see scriptures where cup is used either for God's disfavor or God's favor. Here, it is used for God's disfavor, a cup of fire and brimstone and burning wind. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with Psalms chapter 11. The bad guys get clobbered. So I guess David is continuing his pattern of ending his Psalms on a happy note. So now we're prepared to go to Psalms 12. Psalms 12, 1 through 8, will be entitled, "The Faithful Have Vanished." Sounds like America. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.